Welcome to An Honorable Profession, a podcast giving America hope since 2018. I'm Ryan Coonerty. Along with Debbie Cox Bolton of The New Deal, I'm lucky enough to be your co-host. An Honorable Profession is a New Deal Leaders podcast. The New Deal is an organization that supports the next generation of American leaders. From attorneys generals, to state senators, to mayors, to school board members, these are the people that are pushing policies and politics that will respond to climate change, rebuild our economy, address racial injustice, and restore our democracy. These are incredibly talented people who have dedicated themselves to public service when their country and their communities needed it the most. Check out newdealleaders.org to see what I'm talking about.
Today's episode is part of our months-long Road to November 2024 election series, where Ryan and I talk to political strategists and other key players in swing states about the political landscape and what it will take for Democrats to be successful in November. This week, we sat down with my longtime friend and colleague, Simon Rosenberg, founder of the popular and important Hopium Chronicles, where he advises us to worry less and do more. Simon's a highly sought-after commentator and political strategist, and he talks to Ryan and I about last night's State of the Union address, what's at stake in the November election, why he'd rather be us than them, and how every single one of us can and needs to become an information warrior heading into November. I left feeling optimistic and fired up, and I know you will too. Enjoy. Simon Rosenberg, welcome to An Honorable Profession.
It's great to be here, Debbie. It's great to see you again.
So great to see you again. Simon and I have known each other for 30 years, and this is so exciting for Ryan and I because we're talking to you in a very busy political week where a lot happened. And so you are the perfect guest for us to kind of unpack all of this with. So I'm going to start with a question and then I'll let Ryan jump in. But my first question is, I'm going to read your headline from today from your Substack. The president is clearly fighting for us. Now we need to fight for him. State of the Union was last night. What did you think?
It was great. I think he exceeded expectations. I think both in terms of his performance, but also in the fierceness in which he prosecuted his agenda and prosecuted his argument. I mean, I think that from the first moment and the very beginning of the speech, it was clear that he wasn't going to allow MAGA madness to define what he was going to say. And he just had to say he had a bunch of things he really wanted to say and to discuss, and he did it. And I'm really proud of him. I mean, there was a lot of, I think, courage in this speech. And, you know, hearkening back to FDR's Four Freedoms speech at the very beginning, which is very near and dear to my heart, I also think was very inspirational because to me, it's the most important speech ever given by a Democratic political leader in our history. And he went right back to that core foundational speech of the modern Democratic Party, where FDR articulated that he wanted to build a world based on freedom, the four freedoms, and not one based on dominion and authoritarianism. And Biden started the speech with an evocation of that. That speech, which has been, to me, is the foundational speech of the modern Democratic Party.
Can I ask, because I think that resonated exactly with me as well. We live in a fractured, highly polarized world. I think you've been a little bit of an outlier in saying, look, we can still find common ground messaging that can break through all these divisions. Do you see this as a strategy that can continue forward as this campaign only gets more crazy over the coming months?
Yeah. Listen, I think that we have to recognize that, except for those of you who are in very red areas, you know, at a national level, 60% of the country is available to us and 40% isn't. And we have to be a little bit more disciplined, I think, in recognizing that we're only really talking to the 60 at a national level, right? Not in individual states and districts and so on. And that right now, that 60 is very available to us, perhaps more available to us than it's been in a long time, because MAGA is a failed politics. It lost in 2018, 2020, 2022, and 2023. And now they're doubling down on MAGA. They're pushing a politics to the country that has already been rejected repeatedly. And I think what it's doing is that it's creating an opening for us to reach lots of people that may not have been available to us before. We saw it in 2022 in the elections, right? We got all the way up to 59% in Colorado and 57% in Pennsylvania, 55% in Michigan, 54 in New Hampshire. We took away a Wisconsin Supreme Court seat in 23. We took away the Virginia State House, the six-week abortion ban in Ohio, Colorado Springs, and Jacksonville, Florida, two of the largest Republican cities in the country. We keep taking stuff away from them because MAGA is unable to bring along parts of the Republican coalition that they need to win. And I think for us, this, I've always viewed this cycle as being one where we have to have enormous ambition, that we should be thinking about getting to 55% in this national election and trying to win this election by 8 to 10 points and not a squeaking and falling over the finish line at the end, because I think their extremism is creating openings for us to take stuff away from them, geographic and demographic opportunities. And so I think this is a cycle of expansion and growth for us. And I worry, in some ways, my greatest worry, and I'm not a worrier, at Hopium Chronicles, my new community, we talk about how we do more, worry less. So this is one of the core phrases, is that I'm concerned in some ways that we're not going to, that our greatest failure this cycle could be because we're not ambitious enough. We're not taking enough risks. We're not seizing the opportunities that I think are in front of us now. And I think Biden last night took the big swing. I mean, I was really proud because, look, he took a big swing as a legislator and president in 21 and 22. Now we need to take a big swing politically, I think, and really try to make this election an 8 to 10 point win. And we need to make it a blowout. And we need to make it a blowout because it's the only way that we're going to start to loosen MAGA's dark grip on the Republican Party is if the Republicans conclude it's a losing strategy for them. I think that opportunity is there for us if we work really hard and try to take big risks and go big this cycle.
Can I ask just as a follow-up? I mean, I think we have a lot of state and local leaders who are inclined to take big swings legislatively. I think you've articulated a difference between a big swing politically and a big swing legislatively. How much should the Democratic Party be out promoting big ideas, big change from a legislative point of view versus a political point of view where there's an opponent?
Well, what I mean by going big politically, and let me answer your question sort of backwards, is that what I mean by going big politically is that I think that, you know, imagine if Mitt Romney and Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger and all these former Republicans, Joe Scarborough and everybody else, right, all campaign with Joe Biden, and that we sort of build a temporary pro-democracy coalition where we're sort of transcending the traditional ideological, you know, orientation of the U.S. of left, right, and center and really building it around pro-democracy and anti-democracy or illiberal, right? And I think we have an opportunity here to do something really historic and profound where we can welcome in Donald Trump in his idiocy and his impulsiveness just in the last few days has told the Haley voters, the 20 to 30% of the Republican Party that's not so sure about MAGA, that he doesn't want them in their party. I mean, this is a guy who lost the last election. He needs to grow his vote, not shrink it. And what he told the Haley voters is that, you know, he doesn't want them in their party. And Joe Biden, to his credit, immediately came out and said, if he doesn't want you all, I want you in my campaign, right? And I think we have to be open to understanding, you know, one of the things I talk about when I speak to Democrats is that for all those Republicans that you know that have left the party and or are temporarily dislocated from the Republican Party, we need to make clear there's a seat at our table for them. And we then need to build this kind of expansive coalition. I mean, if we lived in a parliamentary system, right, Liz Cheney and Mitt Romney would have started a new party. It would be more of a traditional center-right party broken off from the nationalistic right-wing party. And it would have folded into our coalition. And Liz Cheney would have a cabinet seat in our government, right, if this was a more traditional parliamentary system. This time, I think, not only nationally, but in states. I mean, these kinds of Republicans that split off from the Republican Party played a major role in our victories in Michigan and Nevada and Arizona this last cycle, right, in Colorado and other places, in Pennsylvania. And so what I'm talking about is not only pushing our coalition to the upper end of what's possible, which I think we can do with this sort of supercharged grassroots that we have now, but also building this kind of expansive coalition. In terms of your question, though, what's going to be very interesting is about whether or not Joe Biden is going to be somebody who's defending order and the status quo against a type of change that's dangerous. Is it possible that after COVID and all the dislocation of COVID and the fear of insurrection and all the bad change that we've seen and all the dislocation we've seen, this is a time for actually slow and steady and not something radical and risky? And I just don't know that. And I think that this notion, for example, on the border, where we're now the party who wants to bring order to the border and they're the ones who want to create chaos and leave it chaotic, is a sign of the kind of thing I think that's going to happen, is that Joe Biden is this kind of familiar, steady, rock bed, patriotic American versus this dangerous threat that's coming from MAGA. And so it's possible that this is going to be more of a slow and steady election, right, than sort of a big change election. Because the change that's being proposed is bad change, right? It's the Trump change. It's the end of American democracy. It's the 10% tariffs destroying the global economy. It's ending rights and freedoms for women in unprecedented ways. The change, the party of change right now is the Republican Party. It's not us. And they're the party of bad change. We're the party of continuity, patriotism, love of country. And I'll take that contrast every day of the week.
Makes sense.
Yeah, it does make sense. And I mean, sticking on the contrasting stuff, I mean, I thought that the president did an amazing job last night just reminding us of all of the success he's had and that Democrats have delivered, you know, I mean, from everything from chips to IRA to infrastructure, ARPA, everything. So my question to you is, you know, it feels like we still have a way to go to, like, I guess, does it matter, right? It feels like we have a way to go to remind people. There still seems to be a disconnect between what people know that the president and the administration has done and what they've actually done. Like, does that matter at the end of the day, A? Yeah. And if not, how are we going to make the people understand that or know about it?
So listen, one of the reasons I'm so optimistic about this election is not only because the Republicans are the ugliest party that we've seen in America since the Democratic Party of the 1850s, but because Joe Biden's been a really good president and the country's clearly better off. And I've been saying for months that we're going to have a very strong argument to make for his reelection. And I think we heard it last night. I mean, that was an incredibly compelling argument and long, by the way, an hour long, right? Or whatever it was, close to an hour, whatever you wanted to hear, we heard it last night. And written, by the way, by Bruce Reed. And I learned this morning that Bruce Reed, this was the 17th State of the Union that he helped write. You should try to get him on here to talk about
that. I should. He's a former boss.
Bruce is an old friend, right? Bruce is an old friend of ours and very proud of Bruce. It was probably his best State of the Union. And hardest. This was a hard one, right? Because the president was addressing the failures of the other party right to their face last night, right?
Yes.
And pushing it. So listen, I think my view on this is that right now, some of our coalition has wandered, right? We have a wandering coalition, that we're not where we want to be. But I think that once it is clear to everybody that it's Trump and Biden, a big chunk of our coalition is going to come home. Not all of it, but a big chunk of it will come home. And I think that part of what's going to cause that coalition to come home faster and for us to win the election is that we have to do two things, right? We have to make the case, you know, every incumbent, all of you have run for re-election. The basic question you have to answer is, you know, did you do what you promised and have you done a good job? I think we can make that case. Joe Biden made that case. And then we have to talk about what we're going to do in the next 4 years. I think that we recognize the campaign is just turning on, that the State of the Union was really the first day of the general election campaign. And we know from polling and research that voters don't know much about what Biden's done. And when they're informed, his numbers go way up. And we saw that even in the flash polling that CNN did last night for people who's polled before the State of the Union and after the State of the Union in terms of their opinion of his agenda, it went up by 17 points, right? So we know two things, I think, about this election based on those of us who've been in the business for a long time. We know that when we make our cases, numbers are going to go up, and I think it will put us in a strong – my own view is I think we should be up by 2, 3, 4 points in national polling by May is my guess about what's going to happen. But we also know there's a lot of information that voters don't have about Trump that they're about to find out. And I want to do this because I think it's really important for all of us who talk to voters to start getting – to not obey in advance, to not self-censor what we have to say about Trump, because I think we have an obligation to tell the truth about who Trump is today, not who Trump was in 2020. And there are 6 things I think the campaign is going to be able to share with voters that they didn't know about Trump, which I think is going to make it almost impossible for him to win the election. Number one is that he raped E. Jean Carroll in a department store dressing room. Number two, that he oversaw one of the biggest financial frauds in all of American history. He and his family, by the way, together, because 2 of his kids have also now been banned from doing business in New York as well. It hasn't gotten as much attention. And then he owes hundreds of millions of dollars in fines and penalties. 3, that he led an insurrection against the United States, that he led an armed attack against the Capitol on one of the only days that all 435 members were there and present. And he promised to finish the job and end American democracy if he's elected, if he somehow gets into the White House in January of 2025. That he's 4th, he stole America's secrets. He lied to the FBI about it. And he has shared those secrets with other people. 5th, he and his family have corruptly taken more money from foreign governments than any family in American history. And six, that he's singularly responsible for ending Roe and stripping the rights and freedoms away of more than half the population. Any one of those six things, I think, is going to be a potential disqualifier for Trump in this election. He's going to have to overcome all six. And I don't think he has the political skill and dexterity to be able to manage what's about to come in this campaign. And I think it's incumbent upon us, right? We're all happy warrior, New Deal warriors here, right? New Deal leaders and New Deal warriors. And we want to keep our smile and keep things optimistic and hopeful. But we also have really important work to do, and we can't shy away from it. We have an obligation to tell the truth about what a dangerous threat he is. Donald Trump is the most dangerous threat to our democracy that's emerged in all of our history. And we need to be honest about this. It's our obligation as leaders to tell the truth to our fellow citizens. And so I'm very confident, Deb, that if you're looking at a chessboard, you look at our pieces and their pieces, and you push the game forward, I am very optimistic that we're going to win this election.
Before we move off Trump, Ryan, can I just ask this question? I think you're right, Simon. I really do. But my question is, like, this is a really unusual election. People know Trump, right? Or think they know Trump, right? This is unique. Why is what you just said in a very, really concise, very compelling way, but like, why is that not moving people yet? Why are there so many people who are just willing to overlook those things, the six things you just said?
I don't know that they know these things. I don't know. I think they know that Trump's in trials and these have happened. People are not paying that close attention to the election. And we know from polling, the polling we've gotten from the first four states is actually more important than any of the national polling, because these are voters who've had to think about, they've seen ads, they've seen the candidates, they've actually, many in cases, they've actually voted or they knew they were going to vote. And we know from the polling in the early states that there is a big chunk of the Republican electorate, 20-30%, who have said that if Trump is found guilty of a crime, that they would not vote for him. We know that from the Haley voters, that more in several of the states, more Haley voters said they would vote for Biden in the general election than would vote for Trump. There are now another senator, a Republican senator, just came out in the last 24 hours and said he was not going to vote for Trump in the general election. These are unprecedented events that we're seeing. We've never seen polling since I've been in the business, going all the way back to the 1980s, of a large chunk of one party's voters being willing to vote for the other party's nominee this early in the process, right? So I think what we have to recognize is that there's already a lot of polling information and data suggesting massive reservations in the Republican base about Trump. And this shouldn't really be a surprise, because in 2022, the reason that Republicans did so poorly in the battlegrounds was these Trumpy candidates that won in the battlegrounds were unable, they bled Republicans in the general, and they were unable to bring their coalition together. That is the likely scenario with Trump. And it's the likely scenario with Trump because he has, it's my view that what's really happened in the last almost 2 years is that when Dobbs happened, something broke inside the Republican Party. That for a large chunk of Republicans who were not MAGA people, MAGA had just gone too far. This was too much. This is not a party they wanted to be part of anymore. It had become dangerous to them and close to home for many Republicans, right? And so a big chunk of the Republican Party has been loosened from the Republican Party, not only in 2020, but also because of MAGA's horribleness. But now we have the threat to democracy and we have the stripping of rights and freedoms away from more than half the population. And this has created a further loosening of their coalition. And again, we're not speaking beyond the 60, right? We got to stay focused on the 60 and not the 40. And what's happened is that there's now some very large chunk of the electorate that is available to us that wasn't available to us, 2 years and 4 years ago. And we've got to build a politics. We've got to make them welcome. And one of the people that's going to be somebody you know very well, somebody who's going to be working very hard to bring these Republicans along, is going to be Mitch Landrieu in the campaign. And I've spoken to Mitch about this many times. I think the campaign understands the opportunity they have in front of them. And I think this is an area where Deb, to your basic question, there are a lot of Republicans demonstrating in public polling that they have enormous reservations of Trump. And in fact, 30% of the Republican primary voters have been voting for Haley, right? And so they've not just been saying it in polls, they've been doing it in actual elections. And remember, Trump underperformed polling. Now, of all the states that have voted so far, including all the Super Tuesday states, there's only one state where Trump matched his public polling data in that state prior to the actual vote. He's underperformed his polling in all of these states, some by 6, 8, 10 points, some by 15, 20 points. And that's consistent with what we saw in 2022 and 2023, which is that when voters voted, Democrats overperformed, Republicans struggled. And the reason the Republicans keep struggling, again, is because their coalition is splintered and cracked, and they really can't count on this non-MAGA part of the Republican Party coming back and supporting these kind of MAGA candidates. And so it's another, again, it goes back to the central, you know, if I can sort of, my basic orientation on this election is that Joe Biden is a good president. The country's better off. The Democratic Party is strong and winning elections all across the country. And they have Trump, who's the most unfit guy to run for president in all of our history. And that we should be very optimistic that when this plays out over the next 8 months, we're going to have the election we all want to have.
How do you operationalize that message, both of the national campaign and then more importantly, maybe for folks listening who are surrogates in swing states for the Biden campaign, when there's going to be noise and misinformation and both sidesism from voters in the media? What's the discipline and the approach to keep hitting on those six things, even as everyone's trying to pull you away?
I think it's really important that in this information age, and given the Republican information advantage, you know, there's an information asymmetry, right? I mean, they have the right-wing noise machine, Fox News. We don't have any kind of analogous set of institutions on our side. I mean, we have some that are nascent and growing, but, you know, they're louder than we are. And I think what it means is that we have to do two things. One is every elected official in this country who's a Democrat needs to see themselves as information warriors and not just as elected officials. That all of you have, both in your official capacity, in your official side, and in your political side, the ability to be louder every day. And I think we need to be, all of us need to be louder. This is important in whatever tools that we have to be loud. We need to use them to be louder, to match, to sort of minimize the information asymmetry that exists between the two parties. But the second thing that I've been talking to the campaign about a lot is that, you know, I worked in the original war room back in 1992. And when you think of the war room in your mind's eye, right, you think of 20 sweaty kids drinking Red Bulls, producing TikTok videos, right? And I think the way that we need to think of the war room today is 2 to 3 million people networked, wired into the campaign and amplifying the campaign's messages and narratives every day. I mean, if each of us reach, if a million people reach 10 people a day, that's 10 million people. Tucker Carlson in his heyday, the most influential commentator in American politics, reached 3 million people a night. I think we have more capacity as Democrats to close the information gap, the loudness gap, than we understand. And I think it's something where we have to show much more agency. We shouldn't ask for permission. We just need to do it every day. It needs to become part of what it means to be a political leader in the United States, that we're living in this kind of broken information environment. And so this ability to go out every day and be talking to voters and spreading good and positive information, because I think the other piece of this is that MAGA's information strategy is not just about misinforming and putting disinformation. It's about pumping negative sentiment into our discourse every day. They want us to feel bad about our country, our democracy, our leaders, you know, our institutions, each other. They want us to feel bad because when the country has failed, that's when radical solutions then come forward. That's how authoritarians gain power. Part of our job is to counter that negative sentiment with positive sentiment. Is to talk about the greatness and the goodness of America, to talk about the good works of the Democratic Party and Joe Biden. We need to become unyielding in our defense of this remarkable country. And I think if we, I often talk about how at my site, Hopium, what I'm trying to do is to give Americans permission to love their country again. And I think if we operate out of a deep sense of love of country, I think we're going to kick their ass in this election, because love of country, patriotism, is the antidote to nationalism. I think you heard it last night with Joe Biden. I mean, that was a deeply patriotic speech. He's going deep into the core issues around freedom and patriotism and love of country that I think are the kryptonite for the authoritarian right in the United States. And so, look, I think all the tools, we have the tools to go do this. I think one of the things we have to recognize is that, you know, the louder, think of yourself as a member of a chorus that's singing very loudly. You're just one voice, but the louder each of us are, the louder the chorus gets. And I think that's what we all have to be far more conscious about every day, and fighting this information war and winning it every day.
Yeah, that's so great. It strikes me. I mean, my favorite line of the speech last night, Simon, was the, you know, you can't only love your country when you win. I think that kind of goes to what you just said right there, which is, and then this crazy response, right, last night was like, I'm going to paint this picture of America being a terrible place, right? And try to remind you or trying to convince you that that's what we're living in, not this optimistic, hopeful place that the president just laid out. So I think that there's something really to that. I have one other question just about our coalition, which is we're moving into the general election, but certainly it's true that during the primary season, you know, we were seeing some Democrats basically, you know, using their voice to express their differences with opinion with the president on certain things. And even as he's been governing, I've been frustrated by some of the amazing things that the president was able to accomplish. You know, some of our friends on the left have been like, they didn't go far enough or whatever. So I just, my question is, are you optimistic that we can kind of hold together, you know, as across the board? Because it feels like that's what we need to do, given the grave nature of the threat we're against.
Yeah, I think the party, I think the party's more unified potentially today than it's been since we've been in this business. I mean, you know, he had two people ran against him in the primary, Robert Kennedy and Dean Phillips, who he obliterated in the primary, right? And if you look at polling data, his numbers with Democrats are unbelievable. I mean, his favorability with Democrats is the Democrats are on questions of his job approval. He's like plus 60 with Democrats. His approval on the economy is like plus 60. His approval on foreign policy is like plus 50. The party is behind him in a very major way. I think it's okay for us to have debates, right? I think that debates inside, and right now, for example, in Israel Hamas, we're having a spirited debate inside the Democratic Party. I think that's okay. That's a sign of a healthy party, right? I mean, that debates can become are constructive and as opposed to becoming debilitating or destructive. And we have to work. And when I talk about Israel Hamas, is we all have to do a better job at being deeply respectful of one another because we're all part of the same family, big, happy, dysfunctional, center-left, you know, democratic family, right? And I think the disappointment I've had a little bit in this debate is that I think there have been many in this debate who I think have been very disrespectful of the president and have asserted things about his values that I think are untrue and false, and that we need to, what was the old line that Clinton had, I think, or Obama had, which is we need to disagree without being disagreeable, right? But I think I welcome this debate around Israel Hamas. I welcome all these debates. I think I could defend the president when he's done. I think he's done the right thing here. I think it's been a very tough issue. We have work to do. Our coalition has not reassembled. We're not where we want to be, right? We're still in the low to mid 40s in national polling. We want to be up in the mid 50s. So we got a lot of work to do, but the campaign has just started. And what campaigns, and so my own view is that within a few months, and you'll have me back and tell me if I was just spewing crap to you today here, is that I think we're going to be up by 3 or 4 points. And then we have a campaign to go, you know, push it up into the high single digits. Remember what just happened in New York 3. I was very involved in the Swazi race in New York. My Hopium community raised more money for Swazi than anyone else in the country. And I sent thousands of volunteers there. We made 2 million phone calls in New York 3 in 5 weeks. All of you who are elected officials and worked in campaigns know what that means, right? We knocked on 175,000 doors. Every Democratic, registered Democrat in the district got 5 handwritten postcards in New York 3. We are sitting on, in my view, the biggest Democratic and most powerful Democratic political machine that any of us have ever seen in our lifetime. And that machine of hundreds of thousands of proud patriots who love their country are going out an election after election and making their calls and writing their postcards and doing their texts and canvassing and giving our candidates more money than they've ever had before. This energy that we have in the family is our superpower now. And Joe Biden is about to go tap into this. And I think you're going to see, as I was quoted in the Washington Post this week, I think that Joe Biden's campaign is going to have the largest grassroots support system than any presidential campaign's ever had, and that we're going to raise extraordinary amounts of money. There's going to be unprecedented volunteerism. And the Republicans just don't have an answer for this, right? I mean, they don't have this kind of roving band of proud patriots who are going out and pushing our performance to the upper end of what was possible. I mean, Swazi was supposed to win that race by 2 or 3 points. He won by 8. This is, again, consistent with what we've been seeing in elections all across the country, is that when people vote, we overperform expectations and they underperform. And I think the national media has really consistently, I mean, part of what the red wave was about, the fall of the red wave that never came, was that they constantly, consistently overestimated their strength and underestimated ours. I think the same thing is happening now. They're underestimating our strength and overestimating theirs. And it's another reason why I think I'm so confident. I mean, our electoral performance, I just want to remind everybody, what we did in 2018 and 2020 was really important, right? We flipped the House and the Senate. We won the presidency. Taking away the presidency from an incumbent president is not an easy thing to do. But then what's happened since may be even more important than what happened in 2018 and 2020, that post-Dobbs, right, we've gained, you know, the party in power is supposed to lose seats and lose midterm elections and lose off-year elections and lose special elections. And the exact opposite has happened. Something historic has happened. We're defying history. We didn't just defy history in 2022. I mean, 2023 was a blue wave year all across America. The Republicans had nothing to show in any election all across the country in all of 2023. And then in early 2024, we began the year by flipping an Orlando House seat to, you know, Tom Keene's race. We just pushed the upper end of what's possible in New York 3. Biden crushed his two potential opponents in the primary. And Donald Trump has underperformed repeatedly public polling. Their party is broke. Their hard dollar apparatus is collapsing in front of our eyes, right? He's spending more money than he's taking in. Dozens of Republican leaders all across the country have been indicted for trying to overturn an American election. The Republicans are abandoning ship in the House and retiring in record numbers. All of you who are professionals know what you know, let's be clear about what we're seeing, right? We're seeing the collapse of one of our two political parties. And I think one of the stories that is going to start getting written is this hard dollar. You know, part of what's happened, I think, post-Dobbs is that not only have upper income educated people moved into the swing, you know, suburbanites moved more into our column, which has created more votes for us, but it's also denying Republicans money and giving it to us. Because those swing suburbanites, you know, were the $1,000 donors to the Republican Party. And one of the reasons that they're struggling with hard dollars, because, you know, in 2022, our swing district candidates in the House and Senate outraised their Republican counterparts by 4-5-1 in virtually every race in the country. In 2022, we crushed the Republicans in fundraising in Virginia, even with all of Youngkin's money, right? We're continually outraising them. Swazi outraised, you know, we spent more money in New York 3 than the Republicans did. Part of the reason that is that, you know, we've now had a shift of moneyed wealthy suburbanites from the Republican camp into ours. And it's not only giving us more votes, it's also giving us more money. That more money is translating to bigger campaigns. Bigger campaigns means we control the information environment and we can push turnout and our GOTV to the upper end of what's possible. This is part of the machine that's being built that we're going to be deploying all across the country in 2024.
I love the optimism. You've mentioned Hopium a couple times. Can you tell our listeners what it is, how they get involved?
Yeah, so I have the organization I ran amazingly, and Deb knows this, for 27 years, NDN, which was part of the constellation of New Democrat organizations that were created many, many years ago. What I shut it down at the beginning of 2023 and have moved my political work to a Substack, which is a community. It's not just a newsletter. I mean, we have 50,000 people now are our subscribers. And we inconsistent with what your whole podcast is about, is that we are a community of doers, right? We do more, worry less. We get very involved in elections. We played a role in the Wisconsin Supreme Court seat in April of 2023. We were very involved in flipping Donna Deegan's race in Jacksonville, Florida. We were involved in the Ohio ballot initiatives. We were involved in played a major role. We were one of the largest donors in the Virginia House and Senate races in the country. We helped Tom Keene win in Florida. We just helped Tom Suozzi win. And now our latest endorsement is, you know, we've been raising money for Joe Biden and the North Carolina Democratic Party. Those have been two of our high priorities. And then we just endorsed Ruben Gallego in Arizona because he's a little behind in fundraising. He needs a little bit of help because of Sinema staying in the race so long. So my community, our Hopium is, the whole idea of Hopium is that what we like to say is that Hopium is hope with a plan. We just don't hope elections are going to turn out well for us. We go do the work to make it so. And so this is a channeling, part of the goal here is to channel all this anxiety and fear and frustration that we have about our current politics into helping us win. We just turned a year old yesterday. We had our first birthday. I was honored that as part of our first birthday party, Gavin Newsom came and joined us the other night, and an old friend of mine, and helped us celebrate our first birthday. Gavin's an avid reader of Hopium and talked about how much he gets out of the newsletter and the community every day. But he even said something that was really important to me. I mean, we asked our members to go get involved in the Rudy Salas race in California 2022, where we were a little bit worried about getting Rudy into this crazy jungle primary you have right in California, Deb. I asked people to make calls, and 500 people in the Hopium community clicked through to the phone bank. I don't know how many actually made calls, but Gavin told us when he spoke to us the other night that when he was with Rudy Salas this past weekend, that they all talked about how many phone callers had been generated by the Hopium site. And they were like, what is the Hopium thing, right? You know, and I was really proud of that. And so Gavin said he actually saw the evidence with his own eyes when he was down in Rudy's district this past weekend. So it's been a wonderful experience for me. I mean, one of the great things about Substack, I'll just say two things for all of you professionals in the business. Part of what we're doing, we have to do now, getting back to this loudness challenge that we have, is the Republicans built a lot of their politics through media, right? I mean, let's be clear, the most powerful Republican institution in the country is Fox News. It's not the RNC. The RNC is atrophying. The hard dollar side of the Republican Party is atrophying. Fox News is the Republican Party now, right? And it's a media organization. And with a media organization, you can say and do whatever you want, right? There's no limits. There's no C4, C3 restrictions on speech and political engagement. Because my Substack is a media organization that I run, I can do whatever I want. Say I have total freedom to say anything. I'm not limited by any restrictions, and I can raise unlimited amounts of money without registering as a political action committee or anything else. And I think part of what we need to do is we need to start investing more in media properties, like groups like Resolute Square and Courier Newsroom, who I know you know, Deb, and mm-hmm. Pod Save America and Daily Kos and, you know, Midas Touch and Deep State Radio. I mean, there's starting to be a constellation of center-left media organizations that we own, that we're not buying ad time on someone else's network, that we own, that are part of our family of institutions advancing our politics. And I've been talking about this for a long time. I mean, I started in this business as a TV producer and writer for ABC News, and I grew up in the media business. And so I felt like if I was telling everybody we needed to do this, I needed to do it myself. And so Substack is a very powerful platform, and in part because it has great community engagement tools, which is allowing my hundreds of comments every day, people comparing notes on which elections they're working on. It's really a vibrant community of proud patriots who love their country, who have decided they're not going to let their democracy and freedom slip away on their watch. And we go to work every day. And it's been probably the most rewarding thing I've ever done in politics, other than the Clinton victory in 92 and Flip being part of the DCCC in 2018. Because I'm with people every day who get up going to work to save their democracy. And I feel lucky and blessed that I get to be in a community of people like this every day.
Yeah. Well, we feel the same way about New Deal and the people that get up every day and do this too. And I know we're all aligned, and I just will put a personal plug in for your Substack. It's remarkable. And I think everybody who's not subscribed should go subscribe right now. Run, don't walk.
Well, can I tell you a funny, just to end, is that I was at an event in the White House recently, and I can tell this story, is that, and my wife works in the White House, and the president was there, and my wife hollered, "Hey, Simon, somebody wants to meet you." And I looked over, and it was the president. And he came over and he told me how much he loved my Substack and my writing every day. And he called Jill over and we talked about it. And in addition to Gavin Newsom, the president is an avid reader of Hopium. He's a Hopium purveyor, spreader of Hopium himself.
But
it's become, yeah, because look, I think that what I'm trying to do more than anything else, as I said, is that I want what I do, and I'll end with this, is that what I do every morning when I get up, I have a very conscious, when I write every morning, to not start with their arguments about us. I try to not start from a place where I'm responding to them. I want to tell our story. I don't want to respond to their assertions about us. I want to have an independent understanding of who we are and what we're doing and the greatness and goodness of our country and our party and all that stuff. And so what Hopium is, it feels like it's inconsistent some days with the national narrative. And it is, because my narrative is not influenced by the right-wing noise machine. My narrative and my story that I'm telling is the story we need to be telling independent of what they're saying about us. And people sometimes, I think, have a misunderstanding of what we tried to do in the war room in 1992. It wasn't about rapid response. It was about going on offense, telling our story. Bill Clinton, as you know, was not a shy guy. And he went out and wanted to tell his story, argue for his agenda every day. And when attacked, we responded. But it was about winning the information war every day. That's what the war room was in 1992. And I think all of us have to become more conscious that we have to win these big arguments with the Republicans over time. And that the good news is that I think that when you look back since 1989, and I'll end with this, Deb, I'm going too long here, but since 1989, let me leave you with this last point. The president talked last night about FDR's Four Freedoms speech and the speech that he said was in January of 1941. That speech is really why I do what I do every day. And here's why. And this is important for your community to hear. Because that speech laid out a theory of how the world should be organized after World War II that was based upon freedom as a foundational value. And those four freedoms became baked into the Atlantic Charter, which became the foundation of the alliance that won World War II. It became baked into the UN Charter, which is the institution that is now, in theory, crafting this world that we live in today. It became baked into the United Nations, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights in 1948. These four freedoms became the foundation of the modern world. And that modern world has created a golden age in human history. There's never been a better time to be alive than it's been in recent decades. People have more opportunities to do and to pursue their dreams in this period than in any time in human history. Life expectancy has gone from 45 years to 71 years. Extreme poverty has plummeted in raw numbers despite a huge explosion in population. Right, more people have lived under democracies in recent decades than in any other time in human history. And what's important for all of us in this community is that we did that. The Democratic Party did that. The Democratic Party created this golden age in human history. We did that. And we are part of probably the most consequential political force for good in all of human history. And that achievement by us, the fact that we've been able to imagine and build a better world like this, and that world now is under attack by Russia, by Iran, by China, who are trying to end this golden age in human history. And we know that our party was called once before in the 1940s to defend freedom and democracy here and all around the world. We're being called again. And I think the president did what he did last night to let us know, to understand the stakes of this battle and this that we're in, and that the Democratic Party has an enormous obligation to ensure that freedom and democracy prevail here and everywhere. Why? Not just because for our kids and our grandkids, but for the kids and the grandkids of all the people of the world, and to make sure this golden age, this time of unprecedented opportunity, is there for the kids and grandkids of all the people of the world, not just ours. And that's why we're here. That's why you do the work. That's why I do my work. And I just want us to, as we go forward, to be inspired by this incredible thing that our party did, and to make sure that it prevails and is there after we all go to the other side. But thank you guys so much. Appreciate what you do. You're doing incredibly important work, and anything I can do to help you in the battles ahead, please let me know.
Likewise. Thank you so much, Simon. Thanks for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thanks, everybody.
An Honorable Profession is a New Deal Leaders podcast. Thanks to the team at New Deal for producing this episode. We encourage you to bring honor to public service, and because we keep things honorable, no tax dollars are used in the making of this podcast.